You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Liam. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with Ryan Hamilton about the Cabinet reshuffle, the Auckland Housing Amendment Bill and public transport. I also spoke with the Assistant National Secretary of the Air 2 Union, Annie Newman, about the rise in living wage and what it means that minimum wage is lagging behind. And for Dear Science this week, our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern, speaks with us about Artemis 2 and forever chemicals in bacteria. Liam, what have you got for us today?
Hi Alex, I spoke to Sinead Deaton O'Flynn, the agricultural campaigner at Greenpeace Aotearoa, about the result of Greenpeace's lawsuit against Fonterra, which recently admitted to having falsely advertised its butter to consumers, and the impact this will have in New Zealand.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or Waiamai Rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e ware ware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ke ēnei kōrero āno, hei pakehere roki roki mā runga i te pai, tuku tuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia timata te whakatūranga, let's get on with the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week, the Prime Minister revealed his cabinet reshuffle, which saw major changes to the roles of two prominent MPs and ministers, Chris Bishop and Simeon Brown. Last week also saw the passing of the Resource Management Auckland Housing Amendment Bill after years of discussion, paving the way for a new approach to housing density and intensification in the future. Of course, the fuel crisis is still hitting New Zealand and discussions remain about the role what public transport should play and how the government should support public transit. This week, I spoke with National Party MP Ryan Hamilton about each of these topics, beginning with the cabinet reshuffle. Just to get us started, I want to ask some questions about last week's cabinet reshuffle. Obviously, this is a relatively important move, especially looking forward to the rest of the government's term and moving forward into the election. But how confident is the National Party that these changes will strengthen the position of the party?
Oh, you know, we obviously have full confidence in the Prime Minister to make those calls, and he's always said, you know, he's got to make sure he's got the right people in the right places at the right time. And so, yeah, we're just obviously getting in position to put our best foot forward as we move into the campaign period a little bit later this year.
A lot of focus has been on Simeon Brown as kind of a big winner in this reshuffle. Why has the Prime Minister moved to give what is a large portfolio in energy, especially given the fuel crisis, to a minister that's already handling quite large portfolios like health?
Yeah, it wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment on. Obviously, that's something the Prime Minister's chosen for whatever reason. But certainly, Simeon is an impressive minister and got a great track record.
A lot of conversation has also been had around Chris Bishop, kind of conversely losing some roles with Leader of the House and Campaign Chair. What does the National Party have to say, particularly around any concerns that, as somebody whose name frequently has been brought up in conversations about confidence in Christopher Luxon's leadership, that he's had roles stripped away from him in this reshuffle?
I'll just point you to Chris Bishop's own comments where he says, "I serve at the pleasure of the Prime Minister." Obviously, he enjoyed those previous roles, but equally is excited at the huge, you know, responsibility and and honour that comes with the Attorney General. So I'm sure he's got plenty to sink his teeth into with that. And of course, the ongoing RMA reforms and as Minister of Transport, etc., he's got a lot on his plate.
And just kind of looking at the general way that now a lot of these, you know, these positions are sitting, can we expect politicians like Simeon Brown to kind of be playing a major role in the National Party going forward? Obviously, he was already a major MP, but particularly picking up that role of campaign chair, can we expect him to really be a linchpin of the campaign?
Oh, I think it's a strategic role, and obviously he's shown huge competence in other areas. So if that's anything to go by, I think National will be in a great position leading into the campaign.
And moving on, Chris Bishop was also in the news last week over the passing of the Auckland Housing Amendment Bill. What does this bill actually change for housing?
So the Auckland and I guess a lot of councils in the last few years have had a lot of churn around district plans, and one of those things was around the MDRS, or the Medium Density Residential Standards, which essentially was the 3x3 bill, which sort of was a carte blanche approach to, you could put three houses up to three stories high on any section. And it sort of created a bit of a scuttle amongst councils and regions, in that it really forced them to look at the urban planning rules and actually could they have infrastructure in the ground to support that type of development. And so I guess over the last 5 to 6 years, you've seen lots of iterations come, and then I think it was 2 years ago now, we made the MDRS optional for some councils, where they could have a little bit more flexibility around it. Auckland's has obviously been a lot more complex, and when we upzoned for housing, it was sitting at around 2 million, and Aucklanders weren't particularly thrilled with that, because again, it still meant that to achieve that capacity, it had to infiltrate a lot of the suburban areas where, you know, there was concerns from community that would it be appropriate for the character or style or even the infrastructure in some cases of those areas. And so it got scaled back. I think it was sitting around 1.6. And now with further conversations with the mayor and the council, we've landed at 1.4, which we kind of feel is that sweet spot where they can still achieve massive housing growth because they need to, as New Zealand's largest and densest city, but it gives them a little bit more optionality. And obviously our focus is to support it around CBD, town centres, along the city rail link corridor, where it makes sense. And some of the, I guess the forecasting says they'll probably still achieve 1.6 million in terms of housing zone. So we think that number's, you know, that's sort of a happy medium where it's more achievable. It gives more nuance and flexibility to the local communities, but also provides for that sweet spot in terms of growth.
And you've already kind of touched on it there, but obviously a lot of the changes with this bill kind of fall into the council's lap. But what is the government or the National Party's specific kind of vision for how a lot of these changes will play out in Auckland?
Well, I think it's really, our message is let's build density where it makes sense, which is around, you know, the city rail link corridor. So, you know, obviously government over, you know, multiple colours of government in the last, you know, 10 years, I guess, has invested in that city rail link corridor. And when government invests in infrastructure, the land value of that, those areas associated, go up in value because of its benefit, its proximity, its accessibility. But it also makes sense to invest in this. So for investors, it makes sense because the land value goes up, but they can also get the, you know, the tenancies to support and fill it. So I think, like you do in overseas cities, we want to see more density around those types of areas, around the CBD. A lot of CBDs across New Zealand, I can speak for Hamilton as well, you know, we've got big suburban malls. I don't know if you're familiar with the Base. You know, it drew a lot of traffic and retail spending out of the CBDs. And so the CBDs, and this is a phenomenon that's happened around the world in some places, it sort of pulls out, the CBD has to redefine itself. And I think for a lot of us in New Zealand, it's really got to be about live, work and play. How do we get more high density living in central cities So then you have the population, which supports the hospitality and supports those, you know, those local economies. So I think the set's all put up for a lot of that. So it'll be exciting to watch it unfold.
A lot of, at various points kind of during this process, a lot of tension has arisen between particularly Mayor Wayne Brown and ACT Party leader David Seymour over minor parts of these changes. Obviously, the ACT Party has their own stance on a lot of housing intensification issues. Does the National Party kind of want to, especially going forward into maybe the election, is the National Party trying to keep their position on these issues distinct from the ACT parties?
We can't speak for David Seymour and the ACT Party. I'm not quite sure where he's gone in terms of his views lately on that. Our position is pretty clear. We want housing where it makes sense, and obviously that's then got to link up to public transport and accessibility. So that's really where our focus is on.
And just finally, the mayor also has spoken around the government's priorities during the fuel crisis, namely in calling for a focus on kind of public transit in the midst of this fuel crisis. Specifically, he's called for an increase in investment through lowering transit prices. Is this a potential area that we could see the government moving in going forward for support?
I mean, at the moment, we're obviously wanting to do targeted approach. You've heard us talk about targeted, timely and temporary. So we're really wanting to help those that feel the pinch the most, which is around the squeezed middle. We've seen a big lift in public transport uptake, which is obviously fantastic, but that's happened without, you know, government or local government having to reach in and subsidise. So in some ways, you'd argue that the mechanism is working. Where we've obviously tried to support is in that and work families with the $50 a week, but also last week around the disability support, trying to increase that as well. So really targeting where we think our spend can be the most effective rather than sort of a broad-based subsidy where people that may not necessarily need the support as much can still benefit from it.
So is it fair to say that the government is not currently considering any specifically public transport targeted support?
I wouldn't be so bold as to say they're not, but certainly I'm not aware of it at the moment.
That was National MP Ryan Hamilton on about the cabinet reshuffle, the Auckland Housing Amendment Bill, and public transport in the fuel crisis.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
Last week, Fonterra admitted that the claim that its anchor butter came from 100% grass-fed New Zealand cows was false and contravened the Fair Trade Act. Greenpeace, which was behind the lawsuit, argued that cows were being fed palm kernels imported from Southeast Asia, and that therefore this label was misleading to the New Zealand public. I spoke to Sinead Deaton O'Flynn, the agricultural campaigner at Greenpeace Aotearoa, about greenwashing in New Zealand and the impact that this decision will have on the New Zealand dairy industry. Last week, Fonterra admitted it had been mislabeling its anchor butter as 100% New Zealand grass-fed. Could you elaborate to us why the statement was misleading and in breach of the Fair Trading Act?
Yes, absolutely. So as you mentioned, last week, Fonterra publicly admitted to breaking the law by breaching the Fair Trading Act using a logo on its anchor butter that read 100% New Zealand grass-fed. Now, the reason they've had to do that is because this is objectively not true. Fonterra dairy cows are allowed to eat up to 3 kilograms of palm kernel every single day. And palm kernel is a dry, gravelly cow feed that comes from the destroyed rainforests of Southeast Asia. It is certainly not grass, and to claim otherwise is misleading and deceptive.
So you were talking about palm kernel that was used to feed the cows. What is this? What effect does it have on the Indonesian rainforests where it comes from?
So palm kernel is a product of the oil palm industry, an industry which, as we all know, is notorious for driving rainforest destruction across Southeast Asia, for driving rare wildlife to the brink of extinction, for human rights abuses, for illegal operating. And this is where this product comes from. And New Zealand is the world's biggest importer of palm kernel. So literally, we are contributing to the destruction of rainforests to feed the oversized dairy herd here in Aotearoa.
So in terms of the cows, how much of their diet is grass as opposed to other things like palm kernel?
It's really on a farm-by-farm basis, but what we do know is that Fonterra's own rules allow for approximately 3 kilograms of palm kernel to be fed to dairy cows every single day, which is a significant proportion, about 20% on a dry matter basis.
And does this also affect the dairy products that are made?
Yes, so the reason there's this 3 kilogram approximate limit is because in 2017, Fonterra implemented what is called the Fat Evaluation Index because the amount of palm kernel that was being fed to cows actually affected the quality of the butter. And there were reports that people could smell and taste a difference in it. So that's why they've actually brought in this 3 kilogram limit.
The lawsuit was first launched in 2024. How much effort was it to get to this point? And how did Greenpeace gather the evidence to hold Fonterra to account?
The packaging in question was first noticed in 2023, and a complaint was made to the Commerce Commission at that time because of the egregious misleading nature of that logo. The Commerce Commission investigated and found actually that the packaging was likely to mislead customers and sent Fonterra an email about it, but then proceeded to not do anything more about it and basically dropped the case, which meant that it was up to us to pursue that in a court of law, which is why we ended up suing Fonterra.
Do you think the removal of the label will have much of an effect on consumer choices? Was it a large part of the appeal of the butter Fonterra was selling?
I think that Fonterra was using this 100% New Zealand grass-fed label because they know that New Zealanders really care about the environment and would be really horrified to think that the butter they're spreading on their toast is contributing to rainforest destruction. Fonterra have since changed the label as part of our legal settlement, but it still says grass-fed. And you can't see anywhere else on the packaging that grass-fed technically includes palm kernel.
Do you think this will result in better, more ethical butter being sold to New Zealanders?
Yeah, Fonterra have changed the label, but they haven't changed their practices. Fonterra is continuing to allow their dairy cows to eat palm kernel that comes from the destroyed rainforest of Southeast Asia. And in fact, in 2024, or maybe beginning of 2025, it was revealed that importers of palm kernel into New Zealand were actually engaging in buying and selling palm products from inside a wildlife reserve in Southeast Asia, illegally grown palm products from inside this wildlife reserve. And so when we're importing so much palm kernel into New Zealand, it's highly likely that there is illegal palm kernel ending up in New Zealand supply chains and in the butter that we're spreading on our toast.
Fonterra is currently undergoing a change in leadership following the resignation of its CEO, Miles Harrell. Do you think this will result in changes to the way Fonterra operates?
It's not clear who is going to replace Miles Harrell at this point, but I would urge whoever does to take more responsibility for the environment that we all really love and care about here in Aotearoa. And that includes phasing out the use of palm kernel on all of their farms, phasing out the use of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, and really supporting farmers to move away from this intensive style of dairy farming.
Is there support among farmers for moving away from this style of farming?
So we do know that there are lots of farmers across Aotearoa who have moved away from using palm kernel on their farms because they're concerned about the environmental impact.
And finally, how prevalent is greenwashing in New Zealand? And are we likely to see more lawsuits of this kind in the future?
I would say that greenwashing is very prevalent in New Zealand. So this is just one of a number of cases. Last year, Fonterra dropped a product, it's zero carbon milk, because they weren't able to meet the requirements of that labeling. And then they've had to remove their 100% New Zealand grass-fed label. In 2025, Zed Energy settled a greenwash case. But yeah, this is happening with more and more frequency. And I think it shows that big corporations are willing to mislead customers to increase their profits, and that it's really up to us, New Zealanders, to hold them to account and to kind of hold our values strong and call out greenwashing where we see it.
There was Greenpeace spokesperson Sinead Deaton-O'Flynn speaking about greenwashing in the wake of Fonterra's recent admission that its butter packaging was misleading.
And as soon as they saw me, they came bounding over.
Last week, living wage was raised to $29.90. This puts it at roughly $6 more than minimum wage, sparking debate and discussions around the need for a raise in minimum wage, particularly amidst the fuel crisis placing more pressure on Aotearoa's workers. I spoke with Assistant National Secretary of the Air 2 Union, Annie Newman, about living wage, the discrepancy with minimum wage, and the political nature of the government's ability to raise the latter. How does living wage actually work?
Well, the living wage is a standard, and so it's set independently of any single organisation. It's set by the Family Centre Social Policy Research Unit, which is based in the Hutt in Wellington, and they set a standard so that people understand what it takes to live a modest but decent life. So it works as a, you might call it an aspirational target. You could call it a campaigning rate. You could call it a rate that defines the amount a person needs in order to live a decent life.
And with it just to being raised, I think it comes to about $6 more than minimum wage. What does that discrepancy tell us about the state of the cost of living and where workers are?
I think it tells a very important story for Kiwis right now. What it says is that working people are struggling. It's not just people out of work who are struggling. It's also people who are going out and doing 40 hours of work a week, and yet they still cannot afford to live a decent life. It's a really broken social contract in my mind. So I think that what we're seeing is a minimum wage, which is the amount that an employer must pay, being a long way from the living wage, which is the amount a person needs. In fact, it takes us right back to about 2013, when we first set the living wage rate, and there was about a 30% difference. So it got closer and closer and closer about 4 years ago, until now it's gone way apart in a very short period of time.
And so with that in mind, why is minimum wage lagging behind so much?
Well, the minimum wage is set by government. So that's a determination which is entirely political. They'll use a few figures from here and from there. They'll say that they're balancing up the likelihood of unemployment with the needs of workers to have enough to survive. But actually, at the end of the day, it's a political determination. And so, the ACT coalition party didn't want the minimum wage to go up at all. There was big pressure. New Zealand First has always supported a higher minimum wage, and coming down there in the middle is the final decision, which was actually less than the cost of living increase. So it was not enough to keep up with the cost of living for workers.
And so is this issue as simple as the government should raise the minimum wage? Is that something that they can just do? Or does there need to be a little bit more action to get this gap to close?
Well, there's always, to my mind, there's always been action required to get any decent thing through Parliament at all, whether that's unions, communities, faith groups, all of the people that come together under the living wage movement. Their actions have made a difference. So their actions actually made a difference in the government retaining a living wage as part of the procurement rules for the core public service. So that was a big win in very hostile times. But I think that what you'll find is that unless people are fighting to say the minimum wage is not enough, it simply will not go up, because this government, this coalition government, is interested in what is a win for business. They are not interested in ordinary working people.
And, I mean, with that in mind, and you touched on it with, obviously, the ACT Party's opposition to raising the minimum wage, what does it say that the minimum wage is often kind of sidelined and dismissed in wider conversations about the economy or how well people are doing?
Well, that's absolutely true. And if you look at the inflation target for the Reserve Bank, that used to be jobs and inflation. This current coalition government removed the requirement for jobs to be taken into consideration. So the entire orientation of this current government is about what is good for business. And actually, at the end of the day, what you find is if you don't make sure what the government does is also good for working people, then it actually won't benefit businesses as well. And you can see that right now with the number of businesses that are going under. It's enormous. Small to medium-sized New Zealand businesses are going under across construction, but also in the hospitality sector and many other sectors. It's very difficult to do business if workers don't have money in their pockets and they go out and spend it. So we are in a situation where it's not good for anybody. What's good for workers is actually good for business, but that's a hard message to get through.
And obviously, the cost of living crisis has been, you know, rocking Aotearoa for some time now, but particularly looking at the situation now with the fuel crisis going on, really hitting the wallets of New Zealanders hard, what does it say, kind of thinking about the avenues that the government has taken to kind of support struggling New Zealanders with the limited $50 a week support package? What role could raising the minimum wage play here?
Well, I think it's a really important role. It is entirely within the government's brief to increase the minimum wage. They can do anything they like. So they can do that. But they can do other things that affect the spending power of workers. In some countries, they've removed excise tax from petrol. In other countries, they've provided free public transport. In fact, in a couple of states in Australia, they've provided free public transport. There are so many things this government could do that they won't do that would alleviate some of the pressure alongside increasing the minimum wage or alongside making sure that they encourage others to pay the living wage. So I think that there are a lot of, you know, parts of a very complex puzzle, but what we know for sure is that what this government is doing is not helping the life of working people and their families.
And so with that said then, what does Etu in particular kind of want to see from the government, both looking now you know, responding to this fuel crisis, but also with maybe successive governments coming in on really making a stance about supporting New Zealand workers through wage?
Yes, well, one of the things that you can do to support workers through better wages is to support unions to function, because unless there is a dialogue, a debate, an ongoing negotiation about what the terms and conditions will be for workers, then you will find that employers have power over workers and suppress wages. That's just what happened. So globally, we know all the evidence points to better, less inequality, better wage outcomes when you enable unions to operate. This government has kept stripping away the ability of unions to operate. Often seemingly tiny technical things, like that a worker is covered by an existing collective agreement for the first 30 days of their employment. That means that they are not under pressure at the point at which they sign on to take on the job to take less money. If there's a collective agreement there, they should be covered by that. If they decide at the end of 30 days that they're going to not be covered by it, then they go on to an individual employment agreement and they have to negotiate that separately with the employer. If they stay with the collective, then they must be in the union. Now, these are things that ensure collectivism has some weight, has some power behind it on the job, and that brings about better wage outcomes.
And kind of just to wrap up, obviously different parties have different stances on minimum wage, but particularly from those parties who maybe are more likely to kind of look at it as a reasonable tool to use, what sort of stance do you want to see from them going into this election around whether or not they're going to raise minimum wage?
Well, I think that what we should be saying is that everybody should be calling on the next government to implement a living wage, at least within the areas that are under the government's control. And that's a lot of the economy. So when you look at not just the core public service, but the wider state sector, and we're going into schools and hospitals and residential care, the amount of business that the government funds in this country is enormous, but they fund it through private providers. If as a funder, they make the decision that anybody who receives government funding is going to be paid no less than the living wage, you will see a transformation across many, many thousands of workers. So we need to challenge the government to put the money where their mouth is, to actually make sure that all of those people are paid the living wage, and that when it comes to the next minimum wage, they start to take a stepped process towards the minimum wage being the equivalent of the living wage, so that workers always can be guaranteed if they go out and they sell their labour, they will actually get enough money to live as a result of it.
That was Assistant National Secretary of Aotearoa, Annie Newman, on living wage rising and where that leaves minimum wage.
Doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
He's a 20th century boy. With his hands on the rails, trying not to be sick again, and holding on for tomorrow. London ice cracks on a seamless line. He's hanging on for dear life, and so we hold each other tightly.
wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science today, we're joined by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern. Kushla, how are we today?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Good. Nice and wet, gloomy day, telling us that actually maybe the Auckland weather will decide it's no longer summertime. I'm quite excited, but I've been told that I'm weird about liking cold weather. But
You're in the minority there, I think.
Yeah. But anyway, what have you got for us today?
So today we're going to talk about a little bit about Artemis II, because that's got to be on everyone's mind at the moment, and a little bit about forever chemicals and bacteria.
That one sounds honestly terrifying, but I mean, we'll find out.
Artemis II, we'll have a chat about that first.
Yeah.
Just because it has come out of one, it's only just come out of one of its major milestones of the mission, which was it was going to go for the astronauts on the, or the crew on the Artemis II were going to be out of communication for 40 minutes because they're going around the moon, right? And they've just come out of that. And so far, so good. Everything's going well. And so that's really exciting. So for anyone who isn't aware, Artemis II launched last week around about lunchtime Thursday here. So I can tell you there were a lot of excited people in the physics department.
I can imagine.
Working hard while viewing Artemis II launch, which was quite spectacular to watch. So if you haven't checked it out, go to YouTube and have a look at it. It's really quite impressive. And the whole purpose of this mission is basically NASA's trying to reestablish a moon program, basically putting people on the moon again. And so Artemis 1 was a mission that sent this rocket up or this craft up, but it had no crew on it. And so this is the first one that's crewed. So there's four astronauts on it who are spending 10 days in space, and they basically have this really cool sort of trajectory, which is called a free return trajectory. So when they left Earth, they're kind of pointed in a direction that's not pointed to where they'll look at the moon. Because if you're thinking about orbits and travel times and all this, it takes a lot of math to figure out where this thing's got to go and how it's got to travel. So you can actually see online pictures of the path that it has taken and that it will take to get back to Earth. And it's quite an impressive amount of math that's probably gone into doing that. And what's really impressive about this as well is that they will reach these will be the humans that have gone the furthest from Earth ever. So they're going, I think they've just hit their furthest point, and that was about 400,000 kilometres. So no one's been, like the previous records from the 1970s in Apollo 13. So it's been a while since we've been doing any of this sort of exploration.
That's the thing that really gets me with this one, is it's like, I feel like as a kid, I was always like, oh yeah, you know, we went to space, we went to all of these places, and it's like, well, actually, you know, you think about it, 400 kilometers isn't the most, right? But it's so weird, and like, oh, I don't know, it's amazing.
Yeah, sorry, 400,000.
Oh, 400,000, sorry.
You think about it. Yeah, but think about your phone that you have in your hand that you use every day. And I think there's something, I don't remember the exact fact, but the computing power on your phone is pretty similar or is a reasonable proportion of the computing power they had back then to make these Apollo missions work. I just struggle with that concept in my mind. Like, what have we been doing as a society? You know, we got to the moon and then we went, okay, yeah, check that box off. We didn't do any more, and it's a little bit disappointing, but, you know, we're starting to look at it. You know, these missions represent us reinitiating this sort of research, which, you know, it does, you know, there is the kind of, it's a lot of money, it's a lot of work, but it's that global collaboration and that science that comes out of it that's just so amazing. So, you know, like, these crew, they are going to see with their eyes some parts of the moon that we've just never seen before. Like, we've got photos and stuff, but they're actually looking at it. And as there's a quote from the lead scientist for the Artemis missions, Kelsey Young, where she's like, the human eye is basically the best camera that could ever or will ever exist. The number of receptors in the human eye far outweighs what a camera is able to do. So they're kind of just making the point that, you know, actually being able to see this stuff is just so much more than what we get from just photos and imagery alone. Such that they've actually, so they're going to spend like 6 hours documenting and analysing the lunar surface. So that's what they're kind of into at the moment. They're going to see a solar eclipse. They've seen two new craters, and so they've proposed to name these two new craters Integrity, which is the nickname for their spacecraft. And the other one they're naming Carol, which is actually after the mission commander's wife who died of cancer. So that was quite sweet and led to quite an emotional moment in the mission control, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And basically what they're doing is, you know, like this mission, they're not landing. That would be future missions, but this is just to test that Space Launch System rocket. So if you've heard mention of the SLS, that's just the system to propel them out of the atmosphere, that rocket. They're also testing the life support system. So this is, you know, making sure that these systems work and that any future missions won't run into issues. So this is a very brave crew of people that have gone up. They are having a little bit of issues with the toilet, it turns out. So they've had to adapt, but they had backup plans in place. Some of the cool science that's going on the mission is there's something called the Archer payload. So this is the Artemis Research for Crew Health and Readiness. So basically the crew, before they've gone up, while they're up there, and after they come back, they're wearing devices to track their movement and their sleep, to monitor their sleep. And it's basically to study how their health and behavior is affected by being up in space for 10 days. They're also basically taking samples of their saliva, again, before, during, and after. To what the scientists are going to do with that is they're basically looking for immunity biomarkers because they want to better understand how space travel affects our immune system. Because once you're in space, you don't have the atmosphere that's blocking out of a lot of solar radiation. And so what effect does this have? There's also a device where it's been on the International Space Station, but they've sent one up on this mission called an Avatar, which is a virtual astronaut tissue analog response. So basically, it mimics individual organs and gives scientists material to study, again, analysing what does space travel do to our bodies and how does it affect us? And so when they come back, couldn't even fathom to think how many years worth of data there is to analyze from this 10 days trip. God. But I imagine it will be a lot.
Yeah, that's a, I can imagine a lot of, you know, first time back, right? Everything. And yeah. It's a very exciting time. I don't know. Yeah. A lot of, hopefully some cool stuff comes.
Yeah. Well, because again, if you compare it to like the 1970s and when people went up, like, just in terms of science and what we can analyze now is so much different. So, you know, like, whatever they do with the saliva, I imagine some of the methods that they used to study this weren't even conceived of back in the 1970s. So it's really exciting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, wonderful time. Well, you know, sometimes there's things that's a wonderful time to be alive, but it's very exciting.
Yeah.
But, yeah,
I mean,
what...
Sorry, I was just going to make the point, though. It isn't all over for these. Like, they've got to come back. And I did read this fact, which scared me somewhat, but they've thought about this, and that when they re-enter Earth's atmosphere, the outer shell, the outer ceramics of their craft will get to about 2,700 degrees Celsius. It gets hot. So there's still a lot of tense times for that those people involved with the mission before this thing, their crew gets back safe and sound.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is that, you know, everything that I know about re-entry, which is very little, but, you know, it gets hot, it doesn't seem fun at all, and it is terrifying. So, you know, good luck.
Yeah, no, it is really terrifying, but that's where we've, you know, human society, again, has benefited from a lot of the space research that went on in the 1970s and stuff, from the materials that they developed to resist these heats in the air. So, yeah, we'll see in a few days' time.
Yeah. And moving on, what have you got about bacteria?
Okay, so hopefully everyone's heard about PFAS, or forever chemicals. Now, these are officially they're polyfluoral alkyl substrates, or these are chemicals that get used in things like rainproof gear or firefighting foam, Teflon. They're really those chemicals that are water and grease repellent. So we've used them a lot in things that we use that we want to not get saturated, that we want to clean easily and this sort of thing. But what we've discovered about these chemicals is that some of them actually have some pretty serious human health effects if they accumulate in their bodies, and they can cause things like cancer. The other downside of these chemicals is that they don't break down quickly in the environment, because part of the reason that they're so good for us to use is that, you know, you can coat your jacket with these chemicals and it stays water repellent for a very long time because they don't break down. This has led to them accumulating in the environment, and so now there's a lot of effort trying to figure out how to get rid of them. How do we get these get rid of these things from the soil and the areas where, you know, firefighting foam's been used a lot, or like dumps and this sort of thing. So what these scientists did, and I'm not sure why they went down this road. I haven't actually seen what their motivation was, but they had they basically fed some bacteria some of these PFAS chemicals to see if they would incorporate them into themselves, and they did. So it was just a strain of a bacterium that's in the genus Pseudomonas. So that's a pretty common sort of genus. And it incorporated those PFAS chemicals of a type called polyfluoral alkyl carboxylate into its lipid membrane. So they have, they're basically the outer shell of bacteria is a lipid membrane, and it's incorporated those into that. Why it's done that, it's not really clear. This paper is basically just saying it did it. And then they looked at some other types of bacteria, like good old E. coli, which we hear of a lot, and some other sort of species, and they were also incorporating these polyfluoral alkyl carboxylates, maybe not to the same degree, but they were incorporating them. And so this paper was making the point that there's a lot of attention on how the PFAS affects human and environmental health, but we don't actually really understand a lot about how they interact with living systems. So maybe that actually was just their motivation, where they started with bacteria because they're pretty easy to control in the lab in some sense. And so it kind of opens up a lot of area for study in terms of why is the bacteria incorporate these? Mm. What does it mean for the bacteria's life cycle? Can we use bacteria to maybe break up these chemicals into something that's more manageable and that we can deal with more easily in the future?
I have to imagine that's the goal, right? Because, well, I mean, maybe not the goal, but bacteria are amazing at breaking things down. So if we can find a way for that to work, go
exactly.
us.
That's it exactly. Like, we're always, bacteria and the area of bioremediation, where you use bacteria or plants or things to basically clean up the environment, is a massive area of research. And so I think we'll start seeing more of bacteria and PFAS.
Mm. Well, thank you very much. Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kushla, for joining us. Thank you, MOTAT, and thank you, science. Journey into MOTAT on Sunday, 19th April, and spend the day amongst the grass, soil, and garden with Live Day Farming.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
You can't believe it. They found a body buried under the ice.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. National MP Ryan Hamilton, Greenpeace's Sinead Deighton-O'Flynn, E Tū's Annie Newman, and Dr. Kushla McGovern. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got The 1 to 4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.